You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Life's better with American Family Insurance because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Take one. Knock, knock.
Who it is?
Receiving and Dana, and we can't believe you found a fucking podcast.
A podcast.
We're so glad you're listening to it. We would never listen to it.
I don't even want to listen to it to edit it.
I don't even want to wake up in the morning.
Steven and Dana, and we're in the room.
Hey, Roomers.
Hey, Roomers.
You know, we're still in quarantine, and
we're still doing this. And I'm in Astoria, Queens. Steven, where are you?
Washington Heights, New York City. Our lovely and talented guest this week, Harley Gibson.
Hi, how's it going?
Where are you, Carly Gibson?
Yes, one clap. Yes, nothing feels better than one solo clap. Just an echoey clap in the back of the room. Thanks, Mom.
It was heartfelt, and your mom is sitting behind me.
Oh, well, she's dead. So she probably could. She could be. Well, she could be sitting behind you. And also, if she could, she'd be clapping. You're like, you don't know me. Maybe your dead mom and I have a really strong bond. Listen, I don't know. It could be. I'm in Burbank, California, which sounds like, I mean, it's
Ooh,
lovely,
Bob
right?
Hope International.
Bob Hope International. Walt Disney, the animation studios. Yeah, yes. I mean, it sounds lovely because it is gorgeous outside. I mean, I'm going to hurt everyone's feelings if you're anywhere cold, but it's about 87 today and it's beautiful. But like also quarantined, like apocalypse. So like, it's not like I'm out at the beach enjoying this weather. Like I'm inside looking out my window, like little orphan Annie being like, I just want to do hood rat shit with my friends.
Right.
Like hood rat shit.
I just want to do, have you guys ever seen that video of that little kid where he can't be like 6 or 7 years old and they're like, he's there, his parents are like, why did you do that? And he's like, I just wanted to do hood rat shit with my friends.
it's really a beautiful sentiment if you really like pick it apart. It's just it so is. Raw. It's like the rawest thing you could do is hood rat shit.
Yeah, you just want to do with your friends. I miss my friends. I miss that. And I just like, I just miss human, like hugging my friends. And
yeah,
it's just a very strange time. But also,
I was walking
like,
back from the grocery the other day and I recognized a friend from her ponytail. So I just yelled out, sure. I went, Tynan, it's Stephen Farrisee, because I didn't know if she could recognize me.
Behind all of your regalia.
Because I felt like I was, you know, enrobed in... you know, synthetic fibers.
Oh my God. You're like Diane Keaton in First Wives Club. It's me, Annie.
It's Alice.
Is that you? And Annie.
Alice.
Oh, so
yeah. I didn't know I didn't consider, you know, the shoes or the fact that we know each other being an indication of who I could be. But, you know, with the mask and the gloves, I didn't know.
Well,
it's a weird time. It's a weird time, y'all.
Here we are, not face to face.
Not face to face.
We'd like to welcome you to In the Room, Carly
Yes,
Gibson.
Welcome, Carly. Thank you for being here with
me.
Us.
Thank you
for staying exactly in your room.
Yes.
So that we could come to you from our respective rooms.
Yes.
Carly, can I ask you an intimate question?
You can ask me anything you
want.
Okay,
thank you. Can you set the scene a little bit? Where are you? I know you're in Burbank, but let's get smaller. What is your room like? What's around you?
Oh, okay. Okay, Queen. Well, right now I'm coming to you from the dining office, the den office, if you will.
There's a den office upstairs.
You can use the den office. It's going to be immediately to your left when you walk in the door. So yeah, I'm sandwiched in between our desk and our dining room table, staring at my little fish tank full of these four zebra fish that we call the plastics, because they're mean and they bully everyone. And we've not been able to have, we had a betta fish, which are like notoriously supposed to be really like mean fish. And they bullied him until we had to put him in his own quarters. So, yeah, I got lots of natural light. I'm looking out at the blue sky, looking at the wind that hasn't touched my face and I can't tell you when. So yeah, I feel like Anne Frank. That's a false equivalency. I just feel sad.
But I hear it.
It's one we all know and recognize.
Yeah, like I just, like, obviously not a comparable
triumph
to go
like,
through. But,
you know, or Annie, maybe far away, yes. Or maybe real nearby.
And also, like, you know, dead mom. So, like, it just comes full circle. Do you know what I mean?
Right. I'm
like,
I was hoping you'd catch on to that back. And really
you're like,
that.
I really wanted to bring that up again. I was really hoping you were going to get that. I'm just trying to bring it up again. I love it. No, please.
All right, guys. So I'm going to leave this conversation. Stephen, take it away.
Oh, no. I was going to let you run with this.
No, well, we want to, I mean, everyone who listens to this podcast knows who you are, but in case you don't, Carly Gibson is
Broadway's crybaby.
Broadway's
hairspray.
Crybaby. And also star of Stage and Screen.
Oh my God, The Guest Book, One Mississippi.
The Guest Book is on TBS, or was on TBS. There's three seasons, I believe.
There was two. It was two. She was a little short-lived, but what are you gonna do?
It's so, you guys, it's so interesting. It's one of the Greg Garcia's masterpieces. He's, you know him as the creator of My Name is Earl and Raising Hope. So it's that quirky, really formatted, super interesting actors. There's kind of like this world that he creates, which is like, what? But also, there are some normals in there. There are some normal people.
Yeah, Greg has a really great way of walking that line between sort of a heightened sense of reality and also really relatable, palatable, and topical issues that we all sort of face, and sort of the comedy that lies in between those two things. Because what's so interesting about the time that we're living in is how we communicate and sort of relate to one another, and the language that we sort of use to do that. And I think that Greg just has such a wonderfully weird way. I mean, and I've always been attracted to that in my whole career, like not unlike John Waters, you know what I mean? These sort of like storytellers that create these narratives that are so heightened and so, you know, I mean, like Hairspray was such a heightened, ridiculous sort of glossy take on things. You know, she's romanticizing about this shithole town and the everything, but it's beautiful and sweet and still really relatable and honest and raw, and I think that's what touches with people. And so Greg has a way of doing that where like you're laughing at something being really ridiculous, and then you're like, it like gets you, like you were like, I did not come here to feel my feels, but like that ended up happening, and you're like clutching your pearls, you're like
the
not prepared for it.
The tone shifts, so it's smart people would love the show, you know. You can't just sit back and like tune out. It's very smart, it's tender, it's Greg Garcia special.
She is driving the struggle bus today. Hold on a second. Brooklyn Lucille, I'm going to need you to mind your business. Quit barking.
Hi, Brooklyn Lucille.
Oh my gosh. She is too. She's so extra today. So she's 11 now. And so when other people don't ask her permission to exist, she loses her full faculties. And so we're dealing with that a lot right now. It's a whole ordeal, this little miss. No, I mean, listen, I can't speak highly enough about Greg and the type of work and that he creates and getting to do that from an actor standpoint. I mean, listen, every day on set was like taking a masterclass in comedy because it was an anthology comedy series, which was so unorthodox. You know, we see it a lot in like American Horror Story and Room, that HBO show that came out right around the same time as The Guest Book. But you never really see it in comedy with these like standalone sort of episodes that don't, that kind of have a little bit of a through line. And that's where the series regulars, that's where we came in. We kind of carried these through lines. But every week, the story was really about these guests that would come in and stay at these, you know, respected places. And it was like, you know, Stockard Channing and Martha Plimpton and Will Arnett. And I mean, the list goes on and on. It was so insane.
And on.
One of my favorites, Michaela Watkins.
Oh, I like, love Michaela Watkins so much.
She's like,
so
if great. She's in anything, I know that it's freaking quality, man. Like,
oh, and Stephanie Weir. I mean, she's so that I literally Garrett and I will scream, you get off the road, you stupid bitch, to each other like three times a day, because just the delivery of it, it's a Catherine O'Hara type of acting where where the response is like, she's on the side of the road and you hear this off camera, you hear this guy go, get off the road, you stupid bitch. And she turns around and goes, you get off the road, you stupid bitch. And it's the weirdest way to say that line. Like, it's very Olympia Dukakis when she's like, you better run along before you miss the Easter Bunny. Like, why in the world
like, did that inflection go away? Those but choices.
Stephanie Weir does that to me. She makes those choices that are just so unique to her that I just sit like a little kid with my hands under my chin and I'm like, oh, let's do more things, say more things.
Yeah.
Laurie Metcalf has she talks about that a lot. She's like, I just want to have fun. I want to do the opposite of what you think I'm gonna do.
And she, oh my god, she is the other one of mine in Scream 3, is it, or Scream 2, and she's like, Gail, hi. Like, we say Gail, hi all of the time. I don't know. It's the dumbest thing in the world. But literally, like, I have a friend of mine who will call me once every 6 months we talk, and he'll answer the phone and go, Gail, hi. Like, it's my favorite. Oh, it's so
That's
ridiculous.
That's the
but
greatest Laurie Metcalf impression I've ever heard.
Oh, that was
Not fully warm right now, but also I'm 35, so I've got vocal floor work down. I get it very strong in my lower register these days.
Girl, me too. When's your birthday?
August 1st. I'm going to be 36 this year.
Oh, me too. In like 2 days, 3 days.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, quarantine birthday. If they don't let me out of here by my birthday.
They will. In Burbank.
I love only day, like it's happening to me. Have you guys done this yet where you have like allowed yourself to complain or bitch to your friends like first world problems that you're really upset about that like you could never say to another human being because it'd be a full bump
of
your bath?
Of course.
Yeah. That's it's healthy. It's healthy to at least be like, somebody validate my ignorance.
And I feel like I keep wasting therapy minutes because I spend at least 10 apologizing for all the like horrible thoughts that I'm about to tell him I've been having when really there's this horrible pandemic sweeping the world.
I also like reached out to my therapist and was like off session and sent her a text. I've had the same therapist for 16 years now. And so I finally have like she just gave me like her actual phone number not too long ago, which I was like, I wonder like, you know, it's like hard to not overanalyze that and be like, does she feel like I need more?
Sure.
Like, but it was for something else. But I texted her and I was like, I just want you to know, like, it can't be easy in all of this to balance. You know, she has a family and all of her own clients and whatever, and balance that. Like, I'm sure you're feeling a lot of things right now. And I just like want to say, like, you're doing a really good job for what it's worth. I hope you don't feel like that's condescending. And like, you know, I hope that you're finding a healthy place to put all of this, because it's got to be overwhelming with everybody putting all their shit on you. And you're like, me too. So I just, you know, I think it's important to like make sure those therapists are doing okay out there. If you're, because I have a friend of mine who is a behavior therapist, and she's like, I am holding on by a thread because I'm struggling myself, and I have to go in and like put on a face for my patients. And I'm like, oh man, I can't imagine. You get all that darkness dumped on you all day long, and then just trying to like shed that off. I don't know how you do it. I mean, you drink is what you do.
And they don't have experience with this. None of us do. How can they guide others through convincingly?
I don't know if you guys listen to Brené Brown's podcast, not to plug another podcast, but she's everything to me. And she's basically trying to do just that. Like, she's trying to walk everyone through this pandemic right now because it is such an unprecedented first for all of us that it's like, there's no proper way to handle this, you guys. Like, everyone stop. Take judgment out of your vernacular because there is no right or wrong way to do this. Like, just get through it. That's the correct way.
Hunker down and pray for daylight, queens.
Yes.
I can't imagine being someone who people rely on for advice, such as Brené Brown and Oprah and Andrew Cuomo and like the leaders who are like, what, like they have problems, but we're looking to them to be like, are you God? Like, are you, do you have all the answers? I can't imagine the pressure.
Well, and that's the scariest part of it is I think hearing them say, I don't. And we're like, cool. Well, you know what I mean? Like, it's sort of a terrifying thing because we are sort of waiting for that proverbial authority voice. And we certainly are not getting it from Pennsylvania Avenue. That is, you guys, woof.
I can't even buy it in Monopoly anymore.
I go, because you're like, I can't even look at it.
I don't want it.
Yeah, I kind of ignore. I can't look at it. Can't read about it. So my health is fine because I can't imagine just like ingesting all of that negativity and
no, you have fakeness. To limit your news intake every day. Yeah. It's the only way to stay sane. I think the only thing I do is I'll check BBC every once in a while because I like BBC. I feel like they're pretty unbiased and they just kind of report what happened. You know what I mean? Like they're just like, here's some shit that went down today if you're curious. And then I look at the numbers. Like I just look at the numbers to see where we are in the curve. Mm-hmm. And other than that, I do not turn on the news. I don't click on things on Facebook. I absolutely can't. I just cannot unless it relates to like the stock market, which I've been getting into recently.
Are you into it?
What? You guys, I am. I got to tell you, this is the time to do it, if ever, because the stock market has completely bottomed out. And the one thing you can count on in this country is that we care about the stock market. So the stock market will rise again. They will make sure of that. It'll be the last thing that we ever do. Like, it'll be our demise, but it will rise again.
Tell us everything you've learned.
I mean, it's so much. And I will say that it's not as intimidating as I thought. Going into it, it was really overwhelming because it's scary and it's all of these things. You know what? It's really not. The best advice I was ever given is buy into things that you already spend money in, places you already spend money. So like, you know, for instance, like Amazon, you know, I mean, obviously some of these stocks are more expensive, but if you use something like that's a good way, but there are people out there like Jim Cramer is a great stock analysis and he's made people millions of dollars in retirements over the years. He has a daily thing that he comes out and he talks and he breaks stock down and what's going on. Obviously healthcare is a big thing right now. Johnson & Johnson. I invested in them because they're one of the leading companies to come up with a vaccine for the coronavirus, like things like that. So, you know, I mean, it's really easy. I would suggest like get an E-Trade account or one of those like things. You don't have to go through a hedge fund person. You can do all of this yourself now with technology. Just go on and just, they'll show you everything. You can break, you can see the graphs and like how things are doing and you can look at the 3 month and whatever, but it's like gambling. I mean, it appeals to me in all the ways, right? Like I'm just a full blown addict in all the ways. Like I was a big old drug addict in my 20s and like, I'm just like, and I emotionally eat. And it's just like all the things. So like this really appealed to me. I was like, oh, it's just like gambling, but like for real and in my house. So it really speaks to me in all the ways. But you're not supposed to look at it every day. You're supposed to like invest and walk away. I check that shit like every 40 minutes. It's not good for your health. But like,
I mean, it's pre-installed on all of our phones.
It is.
Don't check it every day.
They tell you not to. They're like, you'll go nuts. Because it is like, you'll be like, oh, no, I lost $40 today. And then tomorrow you're up $100. So you're like, oh, okay. But then that didn't last very long. So it's like, you can't look at it every second, every day.
I'm cashing out.
But I will say, like, this is a time, like, our generation historically has not been great in getting involved in the market. Like, it's, and that's what, you know, this country kind of, it needs our generation to get really involved in this kind of stuff in order for us to sustain. So I felt like it was my American duty to sort of educate myself on this and get involved and try to see if I can make a little money in the meantime. Cause I mean, why? Cause it's the apocalypse. Why not?
You know what I mean? You little patriot.
Well, I mean, I feel like people are so, they feel so paralyzed about like not being able to do anything and like, what can they mm-hmm. do? That's a great thing to do and learn about. That's not putting yourself in any danger, really.
And it doesn't, and also education is the only way to take away anxieties and fears, right? Yes, and I think that that's yes. a lot of like what becomes, you know, really intimidating about politics and stock market and, you know, the economy and all the things that are going on. It's just because we feel that it's on a scale more awesome than we're able to completely take in. And that's not true. You know what I mean? I think it's just, you don't know where, we don't know where to go for source information anymore. It's a very terrifying place because we're like, who's going to be lying to me? What if this right. isn't even real? Everybody's trying to, out to get you. Like, we have this really fear-based mentality going into everything. So I don't know. You guys, this is a time to do it. I'm telling you, like, invest in your futures. And I think the only way that we're going to get through this, like I said, the stock market is bottomed out for the first time in like 80 years. It's never looked like this before. So all of the shares, everything is cheap, the cheapest it's been in a really long time. And it's only going to go up when this is over. So things like Live Nation, that's another one. Like all of the concerts and everything are down right now. But the first thing people are, when we're able to get probably on the other side of next year, when things are able to go up, Live Nation's going to go through the roof. That stock. Gonna
yeah, we're
going
to go nuts.
Yeah, people are going to be like, I'm going yeah. to everything.
Yeah.
I'm going to go to Coachella for the first time.
You know what I mean? I mean, I don't know if I'm trying to give the Republicans my money, but like, ooh, what I wouldn't have given to see Beyonce at Coachella.
Honey. Well, that was a ride.
I know. I need to apologize if we hear clicking. My radiator turned on for the first time in a month. So no. that might be clicking away in the back.
I don't hear anything.
Okay, great. Carly, can we rewind to your New York days?
Oh, and then if talk I can about remember you... them.
Or maybe like where did you go to school? Where'd you come from? Where are you from?
So I did not take college. That was not a path for me. I had one of those really sort of unheard of, but like the classic story of being like scouted, but like you never actually knew anybody it happened to, but it did. It happened to me. I was 16 years old and I was doing a show in my hometown regional theater. It used to be called Cherry County Playhouse. It's now been gone under. But they used to do really big productions and they had a big A stage and a B stage and they did the summertime show called Crash Nation. And it was written by Bill Castellino, Bill Whitefield, and Christopher McGovern, all great, incredible artists in New York. And they had written this really young show. This was circa 2001, the summer between my junior and senior year. And it was a 4-person ensemble show, 4 females, 4 males, all between the ages of 16 and 22. They play their own instruments on stage. So it was like Stomp meets Rent meets like Schoolhouse Rock, but like grown. We wow. dealt with like suicide, Cheers. Coming out, abortion, the Columbine massacre, yeah. All of these sort of things, these like angsty, really losing your virginity, like all these angsty sort of teen things, these really heavy topics and conversations put into this like pop rock show where we also like danced with pop bottles and played our own instruments. And it was really fucking cool. It was called Crash Nation. And so they were trying this show out in our hometown in hopes to eventually bring it to New York. They were doing, so they had a lot of New York people coming in to see the show, if that makes sense.
And where are mm-hmm. you? Like what?
I'm in Muskegon, Michigan.
Whoa.
So we're right on the lake. So yeah, so we're just, we sit right on Lake Michigan. I don't know if you've ever been in that area. We're about 45 minutes from Grand Rapids. It's like the bigger town. And it's on the west side of the state. And it's a gorgeous theater. It's been there forever. So I was doing this show. And like I said, a lot of people from New York. And Brett Adams, who owned an agency, one of the older agencies in New York, been around forever, mm-hmm. was Bill Castellino's agent. He came and saw the show because they were obviously looking at it to want to transfer it. And he saw me in the show. And I remember, I mean, obviously, it was like a big to-do when we were like, oh, there's a New York agent here. And we were all like, we're going to Broadway. It was very Goffman.
Like very Goffman.
Just such a government experience. And in fact, like I even remember getting into a fight with like one of my best friends because like we were like, it was the most ridiculous thing. Okay, you guys, because it was just that whole thing. Anyway,
stakes are high. Stakes are high.
The stakes were everything. And so so hyperbolic, but like also that was me. So cut to, so I meet him after the show. He was like, great job. And that I was like, that's it. I was crushed and whatever. And so like cut to the Christmas that following year, this is like during my senior year, and I had more absences than I had gone to actual class. So like I was already struggling with not graduating and or the threat of not graduating. And I got this phone call out of the blue. I remember my mom came to the school. I was in my sixth hour and I thought I was like, who died? Because I had a lot of deaths that year. And I was like, now what? My mom comes in. She's like, I mean, this is how naive we were. She's like, she comes in, she's like all frantic and she pulls me out of class and she's like, Broadway called. Like as if there was just like an actual company called Broadway that just like did all the shows and that there's like one lady in a tight sweater, like at a typewriter. And she's like, hello, gonna make a college Gibson. This is Broadway calling. That's kind of what we envisioned. Like we had no idea. We were so far from it geographically.
Listen,
all the ways. Yeah, we're gonna make you a star, kid. And and that's kind of how Brett was, to be honest with you. Like, so I was like, what? And so she's like, this guy, Brett Adams, called, and they want to see you for this role. You have to call them. So I asked my teacher, I was like, can I use the phone? I have to call Broadway. And on the phone. This is a true story. I got on the phone at school. I had to like dial long distance, which was a big deal at the time.
Remember?
This is just 2001. So to dial a 212 landline number in New York was like a big deal. And this gentleman, Ken, who then became my agent, answered the phone and I was like, hi, this is Carly Gibson. I'm calling for Broadway. And he was like, let me get you on the phone. And so basically what they said, they were like, look, there's this new show coming out. It's called Hairspray. Brett remembered you from the summer. He feels like you would be perfect for the show. We want to get you out an audition. Would you be able to do that? And I was like, yeah, I'll be there tomorrow. And he's like, well, calm down. It's not, we're still waiting to find out a few, you know, details and what have you, but we'll keep you posted. And I was like, great. I hung up the phone. I was like, I'm moving to New York. My life is planned. I'm going to be on Broadway, like this whole thing. And I was like, I can quit school because I don't need any of this. And so it was the whole thing. And so like 3 months went by and I didn't hear anything. Okay. And I was devastated because of course, like I had ran my mouth at school and everyone's like, she made it up. Like she lied. Like, no, she's not. And I was like, no, they called. You don't understand. And so finally we called and they were like, look, here's the deal. They're going to Seattle with the show. They're doing an out-of-town workshop, and they've decided post the workshop that they did. Remember workshop when that was a word, not lab? Okay, thanks.
Remember?
Remember when that was a thing? Also, this is how old I am. Remember when you had to call in to get your schedule the next day? There was no email. Not everybody had emails back then. There was a phone number, an actual phone number that you called and waited to find out what your call time was the next day for rehearsal.
Oh, my God.
That's I remember how old doing I am. That for background casting.
Very long time that's ago. That's how old I am. So anyways, where was I? Oh, I forgot what I was talking about. I called and they said there's this girl named Marissa and they'd used her in the workshops and it looks like they're going to use her moving forward. But the show's got a lot of buzz about it and I'm sure there'll be a tour and we'll keep you in mind. So I was crushed. This is like circa like March and I'm like, but that was what I was going to do with my life. So what do I do now? And they were like, I don't know. Good luck with your projects, kid. I was basically not graduating at the time. I didn't have enough credits and I had promised the school that I was doing these correspondence classes and they were like, okay, we'll let you walk in the ceremony since you're really close to getting your credits and you promise you're doing your correspondence classes, but I did not. What I did do was throw a fake graduation party, tell everyone that I graduated early, took that money and moved to New York City with it. So, to this day, I don't have a high school diploma. So yeah, I'm a high school dropout. And so I moved to New York City when I was 17. And I was lucky enough because I had met this wonderful guy named Leonard Sullivan, who's still one of my very best friends to this day, who incidentally, so we did the Crash Nation show together and I moved to New York in the little shoebox at 103 in Manhattan with him in that summer. And we lived together. And then while I was there, they were like, okay, there's going to be a tour. And I started auditioning for it and I had like 9 auditions or 10 auditions over like four or 5 months. It was really rigorous. They were really just like paring us down and vetting us really, really hard. And so it's like we started off with like maybe 30 girls. And by the end, there were 4 of us. And it was me, Kathy Breyer, Kayla Settle, and Shannon Durig. And the 4 of us all knew that we were going to be going somewhere at that point. We just didn't know how the placement was going to work out because they were looking for a tour and a tour understudy, a Broadway replacement for Marissa, and an understudy replacement for Broadway. So we had gotten down to the nitty gritty, and I finally got the phone call that following spring. So that was like March or April-ish of 2003. And because it was the summer of 2002 that I moved there. And yeah, I got that phone call and they were like, you're gonna be the tour Tracy. Obviously, Kathy went to New York. Shannon became her understudy. I was originating the tour. And then Keala was my understudy. And then, yeah. And so that's kind of how it happened. And then I went out on the road. I was on the road for 6 months. And then they pulled me off the tour to go to New York to reopen the show with Michael McKeon because Harvey was leaving the show. Marissa had left at the 1 year mark right when we opened the tour. And then Harvey stayed for another 6 months and they were really worried when Harvey was leaving the show. Cause as you know, he was such a heart of the show along with Marissa, but they were so afraid that when Harvey left, they wouldn't know what to do. So I was getting really good reviews on the road. And so they were like, fuck it. We're going to stunt the fuck out of this. She's young. She's getting good reviews. We're going to bring Michael McKeon in. So they shut the show down for like a hot minute. We cleaned it. They put us in. They like vamped up the show, added a few more jokes, jazzed up some of the arrangements, and we reopened the show to the New York press. And that's how I got my New York Times review. Because normally when you come into a show as a replacement, you're not getting reviewed, but they reopened the show as like this whole spectacular like press thing. So that's how I ended up getting like my New York Times review. Well, I got reviewed and everything, but that's how I got my New York review. And I was 19 years old. I was 19 years old.
You're Muhammad Ali, basically. Like that's
basically.
That means my head like added that all together. That's insane, Carly.
I know. And then I was on drugs. And look, I mean, it's, you know, it's just like.
Well, can I just interject here and say, when I told my roommate, OMGYG, we just booked Carly Gibson, he said, and I quote, she's the reason why I got into theater. And because he saw you on the tour and it just blew his fucking mind. And now he's a playwright. And I'd ask him to pop in, but
really
he's busy.
I really love that.
Yeah.
I really love that. You have no idea. I mean, look, I mean, that's all. I don't think any of us go into this hoping that someday we're an influence, but I think we all go into art because we were influenced, hoping to leave the same or similar mark behind for someone else to have and take the torch and go forward with their art and change the world. You know what I mean? Like that's what we do it for. I mean, and it took me a while, I think, to get to that place. Listen, I think I quantified this whole experience a lot differently in different stages of my life. When I first started out in my 20s, I sort of quantified success by fame, right? Mm-hmm. By how many people knew me and all of that. And like the older I get, the more I realize that fame is not what I'm seeking at all. I always jokingly tell people like my desire in life. I don't know.
That's my mariachi window. Band. Hold on.
The mariachi band. Wait, no, what you were saying was so tender and I need you to start over.
I'm sorry. No, you were quantifying success by fame.
Yes.
No, I mean, I do think that in my 20s, I spent a lot of time quantifying success by fame. I think the older I get, the more I realize that there was absolutely no happiness in that. I think that path that you're trying to take to chase that dragon, and it is a dragon that you're chasing, is laden with false, so much falsity that there's no truth in it. There's no real friendships. There's no grounding to it whatsoever. And so it's really easy to sort of fall into these pitfalls. And I mean, I joke about New York and my drug use and all that, but that time in my life is foggy because I was chasing this dragon, trying to be happy, trying to make everyone happy, trying to prove I was all of these things, trying to be everything that everyone needed, afraid of being seen as a fraud, afraid of people being like, she's not really that talented, just trying to do all of this dance. And it wasn't self-serving. And I was killing myself quite literally trying to do and be all of these things. And then I became resentful because I no longer enjoyed this thing that brought me such joy because it became synonymous with this energy that I had to put into all of this toxic shit in my life. And so it took me a long time to go through, compartmentalize and sort through all of those things and separate them yet again and differentiate and discern the difference between who I am and what I do. And that belongs to me and that I don't owe it to anybody and it doesn't belong to anybody else. And if somebody enjoys it, wonderful, but I don't owe it to you. I don't owe it to you. And that's where you know, everybody, the question people ask me all the time is like, would you ever go back to Broadway? And my answer is probably not. I know that people don't want to hear that. It just wasn't for me. The experiences that I had were lovely and life-changing, and I'm always so grateful for the opportunities I was given. Tracy's one of the best experiences I've ever had. Mm. But the personal experiences I had, the people, the way I was burned, that experience, that part of it, just made me not love that craft anymore, that part of it. And I don't know if I'll ever re-fall in love with theater again in that way. But there was a micromanaging to it as well that I didn't enjoy, that I find such a freedom in this medium of television and film, that, like, you know, you're so micromanaged. Everything is like, stand directly here and put your arm here and look at this person and say this line just like this. And it took all this artistic freedom away from me that I just didn't enjoy. Mm. I always tell people, I'm like, there'll never be a time that I go see a show that I don't sob during the opening, like, orchestrations, right? Like, it's overwhelming, yeah, same, the theater same. Experience. It is ingrained in your soul. It's the most beautiful. But sadly, for whatever reason, I have yet to, in the past 10 years, watch a show and think, oh, I wish I was up there. Mm. I don't. I just don't anymore. I just don't, you know, I feel like I did that and I loved it and I'm so grateful for it. But I just think, you know, that's not for everybody. But I had to make this decision after Crybaby that I could no longer stay in that business and continue to take jobs from people who would give their left arm to be there to continue to take roles I only deigned to do. And I had to give myself that permission to say, you have, just because you can doesn't mean you should. And it's time to walk away. You're not happy. And that meant struggling financially for a lot of years. That meant redirecting my career. And, like, I mean, it took me, it was a whirlwind of like 5 years between that and going home with my mom getting sick and being with her for 2 years and being completely off the radar. But it took me about 5 years to redirect, to walk away from that and restart my life here in LA and, like, figure out how and what I wanted to do to be happy. And in doing that, it prepared me and put me in the best emotional and spiritual place to take on what I'm doing now and be able to do it the right way and be grateful and not squander the opportunity.
Wow. You are, okay, you are Brené Brown for theater, first of all. can you speak more on the, because I find that this is kind of a toxic relationship inside of a performer, is who you are and what you do are separate.
I mean, I have to apologize first and foremost. I know a lot of people probably think, like, when you're going to listen to me on a podcast, they're like, but she's not being funny and key. Like, listen, I do like to talk about the shit that I think nobody talks about, because I think we talk enough about the topical shit and we kiki and it's a good time and whatever. And, like, that's what we watch Drag Race for. We love that, right? Mm-hmm. But, like, I'm so not turned on by that shit anymore. Like, to a degree, yes, we all love entertainment, but I really want to talk about the things that, like, that we talk about in dark rooms in friendships with each other, but people are afraid to say out loud and admit out loud. And this idea of, like, giving yourself this permission, like, the separating who I am from what I do is hard because, okay, for instance, you're walking down the street of New York City, right? Let me take you on a little journey here. You run into somebody you haven't, this is pre-coronavirus. Great. You run into somebody you haven't seen in quite a bit. Maybe you worked with them on a show. You know, what's the number one question they're going to ask you?
What are you doing?
What are you working on?
What are you working on? Not how are you? Not how's your mom? Not, hey, I heard you had surgery last year. Like, how's that going? Like, not any of that. You are so quantified in that, in this industry. And it's not just New York. By your latest, you know, you are the whole amalgam of the last thing that you did, right? Mm-hmm. What I've learned in that is that person, first of all, is not fucking interested in what I'm doing. What they want to hear is, hey, I'm not doing anything. Just like you, I haven't been able to book work, so you can feel good about yourself today because I'm struggling too and misery loves company, right? That's what they ultimately want to hear, because you start telling somebody some good news, watch them just completely die inside.
Or
and
they
want
to open
smile.
The window for you to ask what they're doing because they have something great to say.
Well, very that as well. Yeah. Very that as well, right? It's just a loaded, it's just a rhetorical question while they, like, wait for you to get through that part of it so they can be like, and now for me, my news. And I got really tired of that. And so I stopped answering that question. Like, that's where it started for me. Like, this, I drew a line in the sand and made a boundary. And when people said, hey, what are you up to? And I said, I'm doing really well. How are you doing? Like, I stopped allowing that question to be to be permissible at all anymore. Like, that's not an acceptable way to talk to someone anymore. God damn it, we're done with that. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, that's not acceptable anymore. If you know me, then you'll know what's going on in my life. Mm-hmm. If you don't, then that's none of your business. And or you'll find out when, like, the press release comes out and then you can eat it. But, like, you know what I mean? But, like, other than that, I don't need to do this with you. We don't have to do this. That is another, like, point of permission I gave myself that, like, you don't have to be rude. You don't have to be shitty, but you don't have to do this dance with people that we do. We have to pretend that we are this thing all the time. I'm always happy. I'm always in a good mood. I'm always positive. I'm not, right. We have to be our type. Those things. Not all the time. And so I also had to give myself permission when somebody says, how you doing? Not to necessarily go into like, whoa, my dog. Because nobody asked you for that. Okay. I'm gonna tell you right now, when someone says, how you doing? They are not want your full life story and they don't want to know how much debt you're in. And like, that's not how this,
oh my unless God, it's like a that's real all friend. That I tell people, I'll change my ways.
But you can also just say, I guess I'm doing all right. I don't know. Hanging in. Just trying to get through it. How about you? You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't, because those little lies that you're saying to somebody else, to maybe whatever, you're also sort of telling yourself,
yeah,
this is how you should feel, and judging how you really feel. And it becomes this like masquerade and it just feels dirty and it's really unhealthy. So I just started living in this like truthful place all the time. And it was the most freeing thing that I ever did. And that's how I really started to break down who I was versus what I did. And I realized that like the thing that I do is part of what feeds me, right? It's mm-hmm. the nourishment that I need to keep going. And it's this cool thing, but without it, I'm still really cool.
Yes.
Without it, I'm still all of these things. Like, those parts of me are
again.
Not made up. Thanks, Mom. Those parts of me are not only existing, like, you know, because like, it's like, because I'm on TV or because I was in a Broadway show, like, that's cool. But if you met me and you had no idea that I did those things, hopefully you would still think I'm a person of substance and worth. And
I would still want to talk to you. That's 100% right. True.
That's the important thing for people to remember. And I think that people are afraid that if they don't have these things, that no one will find them amusing or worth their time, mm-hmm. or, you know, or they won't get invited to things, or they won't. And if you don't, then that person's doing you a fucking favor. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, I think it's just like, but also you guys, it's just like growing up shit, right? Like, yes, you have to go through all of the things and the crazy toxic friendships. And, you know, it took me just this year to realize that like at 35, I finally arrived at this place where I've realized that these like default settings that I have to protect myself at all times are no longer serving me, right? Mm-hmm. And that I'm no longer in a place where there are people in my life I need protection from. So I can let go. I can relax a little bit and let my guard down because I don't have those people in my life. I've been very careful to not let those people be in my life mm-hmm. anymore. And one of my best friends, Alex Ellison, I'm working on this project with right now. She and I are writing this show and we were just getting ready to go pitch as the world fell apart, but we'll get back to
it. Zoom pitch.
Yes. But she said to me, she was like, you know, sometimes I think that she's like, since I met you, you have always been really staunch on rules. You have these convictions. This is the contracts of who you are. Like, you've always been staunch to that.
Yep.
And I think part of you is afraid to let them go because this bad bitch that's been at the wheel, like, she has gotten you through some shit. Like, she has taken you through. And I think you're afraid to let her go because she's the best soldier you got. But you don't have to fire her, but it's time to retire her. Thank her for her post.
Yeah.
Thank her for her service. Give her a nice place to go sit down because she no longer needs to be in charge.
Yep, like, put her in your backpack.
Absolutely. So it's like, you know, and honestly, like, that's what I think I've been trying to, as much as I can, use this time to do that reflection and do more of the work. You know, it's so quiet and when do we ever get a time to put pause on things and just be with ourselves and maybe you're in a relationship or whatever and have those conversations and, you know, this is not the time for deadlines and expectations and pressure. This is unprecedented. This is the time for patience and kindness and understanding. Correct. And like, that's just where we need to be living right now. And I think that I want to adapt this going forward in my life from here on out. It's like, no more of this bullshit. Cause I could kick it tomorrow. We all could. And then for what? I ran around trying to make all these motherfucking people happy that at the end of the day weren't there, like that didn't matter. No, I'm done. I'm done with that.
Yeah. My friend posted today this picture. It's all spelled out in those big like letter balloons. And it says, you're only unproductive by the standards of the world we lived in 2 months ago. And that world is gone now.
I love that. It is. It is gone. And it needs to stay gone. It really does. And I hope that, you know, I hate that it's happening off the backs of this really awful tragedy. I've lost a couple of friends. It's horrific. And I'm so sad for the people who are in financial ruin from this or have lost family members or are sick. But I hope that some good can come out of this. And the good is that, like, we start to value things in each other a little bit more and we slow down a little bit and we stop putting this pressure to be all of these things on ourselves all the time and just be a little kinder to ourselves mostly.
I think the competition has lifted in a lot of scenarios where, you know, like, oh, my play isn't going to get read, but no one else's is either, you know, or like, oh, no one else is working. I guess we're on the same playing field. So it's an equalizer and it really shows you that you are not who, like, you are different than what you do. That's completely separate.
Such an astute observation. I didn't even really think about it like that, but you're right. Like, we have now stripped away all of these sort of, you know, little what do you call it when you have like a, I don't know, you guys, I'm trying to do like a baseball reference, like stats, all your stats on your card.
Yeah.
That was the hardest thing ever.
Home run, Carly, like, home run.
Right, touchdown. like all of your little like credentials and all your thing, like your little LinkedIn page just went away. And it's like, who are you as a person is all we have right now. Mm-hmm. And that is some dark shit that's why some people are losing their full-blown faculties because it's like that moment in Never Ending Story when you got to stare at yourself in the mirror. And he was like, some people run screaming into the night or whatever, however that voice goes. Yeah. And that's what it is though. People have to look at themselves in this shit. And some people are not, that's why booze sales are through the roof right now.
Carly, I do have to bring it back to your career for a moment in the interest of time. And I would be foolish to let you go without talking about this. We got to talk about One Mississippi because as an actor, as somebody in this business, we all have our shows or our movies or our television stories. And we just think, God, what would I give to be on that set or in that recording session or in that rehearsal room? And One Mississippi is one of those for me. Mm-hmm. God damn it.
Well, I got to tell you, it was for me too. I was such a huge fan. So I lost my mom in 2013 to cancer, but like I was so touched by season one of One Mississippi. I love Tig, obviously. Tig's story is incredible. For people who don't know,
were you a blastronaut?
Go read it. What's that?
Were you a blastronaut? Did you do Tig's podcast?
She was not that hard on my radar. Like I was, I was a fan of some of her stand up, but I didn't even know about the podcast or the Largo show or any of that. Like she wasn't that hard on my radar until One Mississippi. And then of course I like went in a full K-hole and was like, just immersed myself in the whole, everything that is Tig. Mm-hmm. I will tell people, like, if you're not familiar with her story, it's so worth going and just and watching the documentary and all the things. I was a huge fan of the first season. And so when I heard that they were doing the second season, that they were looking for this really heavy role in the, you know, and it's such a small cast and there's such small episodes. So I was chomping at the bit and I was born in Alabama. I kind of grew up in the South before we went to Michigan. So I know these women, I know this woman inside and out. And I was really interested for an acting perspective to play someone that repulsed me, this sort of right-wing religious, you know, climate denying, dinosaurs weren't real, gay people are going to hell. Yes, what would Jesus cook kind of people? And I thought, I know this woman. And what I really wanted to accomplish in the portrayal of that character was not so much like playing the evil of her, was the ignorance of her. You know, we are what we know, right? We are our own personal experiences, and ignorance can really only be your fault if you were never exposed to the objectivity of the other side. So these people live in this world, and to them, like, they'll say something like, you know, well, you know, like, those parts don't go together. I don't get gay stuff. They're not being dicks. They just don't fucking get it. They just, they're just like, I just don't get how that goes. Like, I really don't. Like,
I picture it. What does,
you know what I mean? Like,
well, listen, I'm gay. I literally had those same thoughts. Like, when I realized that two men can have sex looking at each other, it was like maybe a year ago.
Oh my God, was it Queer as Folk? Because for me, it was Queer as Folk. I was watching Queer as Folk and I was like, men can have sex face to face. Like, I mean, I was like, 16 when I saw that?
No, it wasn't Queer as Folk. It was just a conversation. I was like, oh, huh. And I'm but deep in it. So like, I can't imagine like people who I grew up in Wisconsin, like knowing that.
Absolutely. I mean, unless you're educated. And so it was getting to, I mean, I'm telling you, walking on set for the first, it was like being inside the TV, right? Because everything was exactly where it was supposed to be. And I was like, oh my God, I'm in the TV. I'm in the TV set. I will tell you that working with Tig, it was, I mean, beyond a dream. Tig is maybe one of the most precious souls to be around, mostly because she doesn't take it too seriously, right? She's like, she's like, I almost died 4 different times, right? I'm going to say I have breast cancer and the C. diff and thing, like a pneumonia, all the things. So this ain't that, okay? We're making a fucking TV show. Everybody's calm the fuck down. Exactly. Like, we are playing dress up right now, okay?
Yeah.
Let's just be real about what we're doing here. And that made this the whole environment very light and fun, and it was all women run, women showrunner, women writers, women director, women producers. So that was really cool. It was the first time I'd really experienced that. And it was the most efficiently run set I'd ever been on, which I was like, yes, cool. Girls, yes. So it was just a really wonderful experience. And I was beyond, beyond heartbroken when the show got canceled. You know, Amazon, I think, just decided they wanted to chase their Game of Thrones. They spent a bajillion dollars on the rights to the Lord of the Rings stuff. And I think they tried to cut the fat elsewhere. And we were a very big critically acclaimed show, but not a big numbers show. And so it just happens.
Yeah. There were a couple kind of at the beginning of Amazon's original content that I think were just ahead of their time. I think I think you guys could have gone on forever. I think that Maya Rudolph show forever could have gone on for a while. That dealt with some cool shit.
We also had the Louis C.K. stuff. Yeah, you know, he was our executive producer. That was right around Me Too. But then, interestingly enough, we had that whole, you know, storyline going on. The whole storyline of season two was like sexual harassment in the workplace, which they did as a big kind of fuck you to Louis. It was very meta.
Yes, it was.
Like,
very
what was happening.
I think it's a testament and such a pat on the back that it was cut short, because the best shows are. Because they're not pandering to the everyone.
Like Arrested Development.
And the comeback. Like, come on.
Yes, oh my
like,
God, the comeback.
Smartest, most funniest, like, nichiest have been cut short. And
I get what you're saying. It's like being in the 27 Club. You're like, you died early. You like went out in a blaze of glory. I feel you.
I hope that heaven is covered with, you know, a million seasons of the comeback and a million seasons of One Mississippi. Too.
I think that at some point, I mean, I have no idea. I could be talking out of my ass. I just can't imagine. This is just me sort of talking off the cuff. I can't imagine that Tig wouldn't want to explore this at some venture in the future, you know, separate from, like, who knows? Who absolutely knows? Kind of like they did with Comeback, Arrested Development. Although, did we need all those seasons? Did it work? I don't know. I don't know.
Who knows?
But, you know, I'm hoping, and I listen, if that day ever came, I would drop heaven and earth to go and play with those kids again, because all of them.
Shirley Ralph.
Oh my God, Shirley Ralph is so everything to me. And can I tell you that, like, the first couple of days on set, because she's all of the things when she walks into a room. She is pure joy and bliss. It comes out of her pores and radiates out of her. And it's not an act. It's real. This is really who she is. And I remember in the first couple of days, like, I know a lot of the, because she's so theater, and she's like, darling, darling, we're making things. How are we? We're making art today. And, like, nobody does that in TV, right? And so the crew at first, I think, was very like taken aback. They weren't really sure. They were like, oh, wow, okay. And then, but by the end of it, they were like, they didn't know what, did not know what they were going to do without Shirley Ralph in their lives. Like, they just were like, how am I going to ever do a job where this bright light and energy doesn't come hitting me? Like, it was amazing.
Her character too, it just made me laugh because that's the Shirley Ralph I know. I mean, mm-hmm. I know Broadway's Shirley Ralph, and I know Rita Louise Watson.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know her quiet and reserved. And
I know it was so really cool to watch that her work knowing, and to work with her.
Oh, it made me laugh harder than anything watching her. Not
she used to crack react. Me up and takes all the time with that little tiny, just out of four all the time. She'd be like, well, in our world. I was like, I can't with this voice. Like, there are times that she would do it. And I was like, I just need a minute. Hold on. What's happening? Because it was so good. And I'm not a professional at all. Like, so, oh, man, she would get me. She would get me with that all the time. We had one of the best, most scenes that will always stick out is that big dinner scene that we do in towards the end of the season. And we're all around the dinner table. We shot it all night. It was like a big thing because you have to shoot from 9 million different angles. And so we're sitting and whatever. But there was this ridiculous, I don't even know. It was like late. We were over in time. I mean, we're in overtime. It's a whole thing. So everybody's getting restless and we're tired. We were sitting around this thing. And I had to pass that picture of him as a little kid to Cheryl to show her. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, like the director was trying so hard to get, she was like, no, you have, and she was like, just hand it to her. Like you, but when you know, if you've worked in TV, like you don't ever hold something where you would actually hold it. You hold it so the camera can see it. So it looks like you're holding it. And so it was so awkward. I've never felt more mentally challenged in my whole life. And Tig's crying, laughing, like, cause I'm looking at them like, help me figure out how to hold this fucking thing. And they were like, I don't know. And she's over the thing. She's like, just hold it. Like you would hold it. I was like, I feel like this is how I would hold it. I don't see how I'm doing this wrong. And like we just it went on for so long, and finally she was like, we got it, fuck it, we got it. And so every time that I've watched that scene, I've always like, that passing of the thing, because Cheryl's looking at me and I'm literally like, I have tears in my eyes because the camera's behind me so they can't see my face. So I'm looking at Cheryl and I'm like, does this look right? And Cheryl's just looking at me like, I ain't fucking helping you, you're on your own. Oh my god,
I ain't fucking so helping funny. You
I thank you for telling me that story.
She's a magical queen.
She's a magical queen.
But enough about me, let's talk about you. What do you think of me?
We have two questions that we like to ask all of our guests before we let you go. The first is first impressions. We want to know what your first impression of each of us was, which I realize is hard to do on the radio waves.
Well, first impression, but Stephen, you and I've met before, right? Like back in the day in New York.
I actually, while I was doing my research, there's video footage of the night we met because it was at Birdland. Oh, Katie Thompson had a show and you saying, I'm not pregnant, I'm just fat.
Sure.
It was that night. That was the night I met you. So,
oh my God.
Easily traceable.
Well, I got to tell you, it's really hard. Usually people's first memories of me are always like, oh, you were super hammered and you were doing coke off a stripper's asshole. And I'm like, sure, that sounds right. I'm like, that sounds like the night you met me. You guys, first impression, like, what's better than you two? Like, talk about being in the room. What, like, in a warm, inviting, lovely environment to just, like, come and be your authentic self? And, like, what's better than that? Like, you guys are, like, the mom and dad that everybody, like, secretly wants. Not to make us all sound really old, but you know what I mean? Just, like, you're, like, they're, like, come on in. Tell us about your day. That's fine. You can feel that. Oh, you burn that building. Okay, well, you know, we're just going to work through that. We're not judging you here. We are fully supportive. Like, we just want you to be who you are and express who you are. I think you're going to need to get a passport.
Mine.
Girl, what is your Venmo? Because I feel like this was a therapy session. This was a fucking TED Talk. This was everything. So what is your Venmo?
Oh my God, I'll kill you, Dad.
Okay. Next question, Steven.
Make a nice donation to the Cancer Society.
All right. All right.
There you go. Or in Renee Zimmerman. That's my mom's name. Oh, well, you know, because you're best friends with her.
She's on my couch. She's right here.
I was like, you know her.
Hi-ho! Hi-ho!
Question number two goes like this. There are seven very well-known dwarves in history. If you were the eighth dwarf, what would your name be?
Cunty.
There we have it.
Without question. I mean,
you guys...
She's been asked that before.
Well, no, but like that's... if I mean, yes. Like, first of all, if I had to live with seven fucking men in that little house and the only refuge I get is this sleepy-ass bitch who comes in and, like, takes over and they're obsessed with her when I've been the female in the picture for all this time, clearly overlooked, like, clearly running the show. And now this tall, skinny bitch, like, rocks in and they're all like, oh, losing their goddamn minds or whatever. I would be cunty.
They start washing their hands for her.
Okay. Like, shit. Right. I'm like, I've been trying to get you to use a goddamn coaster and this with the...
You're like, bitch, you want an apple?
And this one has shingles and I put the ointments on and like, really? Like, all of a sudden, like, this little fresh face, this little youngin' comes in and y'all are listening. Fuck you. I'll burn this house down.
They have shingles and a coaster? Oh my
yeah.
God.
You know they don't use coasters.
Girl. Wait.
Look at their little hands.
When I'm next in Burbank, I'm going to come find you and trip you. I don't know.
Come find me.
Push you down a hill.
Come to California. We'll go to the beach and we'll do mushrooms. It'll be magical.
That's literally ooh. All I want to do ever.
You're like, wait, can I go?
I'll bring the mic.
Yes. Wow. I adore you. What is going on? Am I in love?
Is this love? Could it be?
I know you're.
You should have found me in my 20s because I used to sleep with a lot of women in my 20s.
Oh, and that's my thing.
You like women that aren't fully. Well, this you sound like my best friend Meg. She's always like, she's bi. I'm like, Meg, no, no more with the bi-curious 22-year-olds.
Really missed my opportunity. Well, where can people find you on the social meds?
They can just at Carly Gibson, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Oh, not Facebook. I'm not going to add you on Facebook.
Yeah, that's for friends.
But I was like, I'm just going to hold you up right now. I'm not going to add you on Facebook. That thing has gotten so out of control anyways. Twitter. I'm not really good at being on Twitter, but I'm on Instagram. I'm always on that. So
yes, queen.
Come find me.
And One Mississippi is included with your Prime membership if you are looking for
it's so good.
Bingeable entertainment. And where can people watch The Guest Book? I obviously TBS, but is it on their app? Is it on demand?
I fucking wish I could tell you because I can't seem to find either TBS. I don't know if it's still on the TBS app. It's not on Netflix. It's not on Hulu. Like right now it just lives in the ether. So
I did buy it on Amazon Prime. So
you did?
You got
so
20
it's rentable.
Cents.
Purchasable.
I think also if you have the Hulu TV, the Hulu Live TV, you can do it.
Yes.
Got it.
And then I think if you have the TBS app as well, she's not as easy to find. She's a little bit harder, but maybe someone's got to pirate it out there. I don't know. If you're one of those smart people that can pirate things and get away with it, put that shit on YouTube. Thanks.
Yeah.
Please and thank you.
He heard it here, folks.
I
and also
tell Ron
Atypical
Howard.
Is another show that I was on this year on Netflix. That one's fun. You should check that out. It's a great show. And the Funny Dance Show. I just did an episode on the Funny Dance Show on E! Which was a lot of fun. I got my dancing shoes back out. I ain't done that in a bajillion years. It was a charity show that I did. Kel Mitchell was my partner.
Oh my God. I just watched Good Burger the other night. It was on Vice.
Well, you got to check out the Funny Dance Show because we did episode 3 and we won. We played for a charity called Down for Dance, which is an organization that teaches dance to individuals with Down syndrome. It's lovely. It's here in LA. It's local. And oh, God, you want your heart to explode?
Yes, I do.
Go to one of those classes because you will never see a more free spirit giving like just everything that they have. You're just like, okay, I'm living my life the wrong way.
Yes.
Like, you just, you're like, okay, I've completely missed the point of all of this. Okay, I'm not doing this right. Yeah. I'm not doing it right.
Well, Carly, thank you again for spending part of your Monday with us.
Well, thank
this is
for
such
having
a treat
me.
To, you know, make something wonderful out of this time and get in touch when, you know, scheduling this in real life would have been a nightmare.
So I know. So good I really appreciate you guys for having me and for, you know, for putting your art out there and doing this platform. And I appreciate you and your contributions. And I want you guys to stay safe and happy and healthy and all the things, and be fruitful and flourish in your lives.
You are a
Amen. All right. Until next time, kids. Bye.
Bye.
Okay. Mwah.
In the Room with Stephen and Dana is produced by Stephen Farazee
and Dana Craig. Special thanks to Joel Wagoner for tinkling the ivories on our theme song. Hit him up at joelwagoner.com.
We apologize, and you're welcome. We'd also like to thank Jesse Wiener, W-I-E-N-E-R, for our jazzy original music sprinkled throughout each episode.
You can find him at jessewiener.com.
Last but certainly not least, we'd like to thank Kevin Thomas Garcia for taking all of our ridiculous photos. You can find him online at ktgnyc.com. We are all over the internet on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at In The Room Pod.
Follow us, like us, share us, pimp us out. And don't forget to subscribe to In The Room Podcast. We everywhere, so subscribe. And thank you so much for listening.
Thank you so much.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.